This is Family Policy Matters. This program is produced by the North Carolina Family Policy Council, a pro-family research and education organization dedicated to strengthening and preserving the family. And now from the studio, here's John Rustin, president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council.
Thank you for joining us this week for Family Policy Matters. It is my pleasure to have Peter Sprigg with us on the program. Peter is Senior Fellow for Policy Studies at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. His research and writing focuses on the issues of marriage and family, as well as human sexuality and religion in public life. Peter is the author of the book Outrage: How Gay Activists and Liberal Judges Are Trashing Democracy to Redefine Marriage. And I would say after the recent Supreme Court ruling, they have certainly done just that. Peter is with us, however, today to discuss a new issue brief that he co-wrote with Dale O'Leary entitled Understanding and Responding to the Transgender Movement. We're going to be talking with Peter today about some of the important issues addressed in this paper. Peter, thanks so much for joining us again on Family Policy Matters.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you, Peter, and so we're so grateful for the work that you and FRC do on behalf of families all across this nation. Now, Peter, as we jump into this issue, the transgender issue is a much-discussed item in the mainstream media these days, especially after former Olympian and gold medal winner Bruce Jenner announced to the world that he wants to be identified as a woman. Define for us, if you would, what you mean in your recent issue brief by the term transgender movement.
Well, as we point out in the introduction to our paper, there's really been an assault on the sexes, what I call an assault on the sexes, underway for a number of decades now. By that, I mean an assault on the idea of male and female as being distinct and separate, and the idea that there are certain distinctives about males and females that make them different from one another. The first wave of this assault could be said to be the radical feminist movement, and a second wave could be the homosexual movement, sort of attacking the idea that men and women are inherently complementary to one another sexually. And this third wave, if you want to call it that, is the transgender movement, which is attacking the idea that men have to remain men or women have to remain women. This is what we see really coming to, as you indicated, a cultural head last month with the coming out as female, so to speak, of Olympian Bruce Jenner.
Well, in the paper, you discuss the differences between gender and sex, at least according to transgender ideology. If you will, for our listeners, explain this distinction and help us understand what is being pushed on our society by those who are promoting this confusion about gender.
Sure. I think to most people, the idea of gender or sex is that those are synonyms. They basically mean the same thing. You're either male or female. That's your gender. That's your sex. There's not a real difference. But among those who push this radical transgender ideology, there is a complete dichotomy between your sex, which is a biological factor, and your gender, which is essentially a psychological factor. It has to do with how you identify yourself. And they do not necessarily accept the premise that your gender is defined by your sex, and that your gender is defined by your biology. Instead, they argue that it's defined by your psychology. And whatever you feel in your mind you are, whether you feel male or you feel female, well, that's what you are. That's how you should present yourself to the world, and that's how the world should accept you, even if it is the opposite of your biological sex. We argue that that's, you know, just contrary to reason, and that, in fact, a person's biological sex is immutable and is the only meaningful thing that defines a person's gender.
Well, one of the important points that you discuss in the paper is how the American Psychiatric Association changed the term for transgenderism, which was previously called gender identity disorder, but is now referred to as gender dysphoria. Explain what happened there and why the shift in this terminology to gender dysphoria is so significant.
Sure. It's Well, let me first review the history of what happened with the topic of homosexuality in the American Psychiatric Association and in the what's called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Way back in 1973, prior to 1973, homosexuality had been listed as a mental disorder in this you know, very prominent book published by the APA. And in 1973, homosexual activists won really one of their first major cultural victories when they managed to persuade the APA to remove homosexuality from their list of mental disorders. Now, that's another whole story. They did this not on the basis of new findings about homosexuality, but by basically redefining what the term mental disorder meant so as to exclude homosexuality from the definition. This was considered a very, you know, sort of a pioneering victory for the homosexual rights movement. Well, the transgender movement has been concerned for a long time about the classification of gender identity disorder and the implication that if you have a psychological gender identity that differs from the biological sex, that you are suffering from a disorder or a disordered condition. And so in the most recent edition of this DSM, which came out in 2013, they persuaded them to change this diagnosis from gender identity disorder to gender dysphoria. And what is implied by the term dysphoria is that this is only a disorder to the extent that it causes subjective distress for the person who feels it. So if you believe that if you're biologically male and you feel that in your psychologically that you are female and you live as a female and it doesn't bother you, then you're considered not to have any disorder at all. You don't have gender dysphoria because you're not experiencing a subjective level of distress about this conflict. But if you are experiencing subjective distress, then you still have gender dysphoria. Now, one question some people ask is, well, why not get eliminated altogether from the DSM like the homosexuals did? But the problem is that the transgender people need a medical diagnosis in order to get insurance companies to pay for their treatment. Now, we would say that the appropriate treatment for gender dysphoria or gender identity disorder, however you want to call it, is psychotherapy to help a person become comfortable with their biological sex. From the perspective of the transgender movement, the treatment that they seek is gender reassignment surgery, which will alter the anatomy of their bodies to make it resemble the sex that they want to be instead of the sex that they actually are. But in any case, they still need a diagnosis, a code that the doctor can put down in order to justify having insurance reimbursed for that type of surgery. So that's why we haven't seen them completely eliminate it from the DSM altogether.
Well, that's interesting, and thanks for sharing that and sharing the background about the beginning of this in the homosexual movement. Now, Peter, we are also hearing more and more disturbing stories of children at younger and younger ages who are identifying as transgender and whose parents, in some cases, are actually embracing and promoting that identity, perhaps allowing their biological boy to dress and identify as a girl or vice versa. Now, your paper addresses gender confusion among children and how to respond to that. Talk about that a little bit, if you will.
Yes, there are a number of children who do experience this sort of gender dysphoria, if you want to call it that. One reason why we're very troubled about, well, there are a couple of reasons why we're troubled about the growing trend towards simply affirming young children as being the opposite of their biological sex, affirming their gender identity in contrast to their biological sex. One reason is that the young people are inherently unstable in their sense of identity. And therefore, we should not assume that just because someone is struggling with this in childhood, that they will not outgrow it or somehow be in a different position by the time they reach adulthood. However, we're now having even medical interventions with minors, such as puberty-blocking hormones, hormones that will be given to a young person before the age of puberty in order to actually prevent them from undergoing the physical changes that take place in puberty. This is intended to prepare them better for gender reassignment surgery once they become an adult, which at least so far they haven't actually been performing surgery on minors, but we're alarmed at this hormone therapy being offered to them either as well. There is the fact that in childhood is when treatment of gender dysphoria can be the most effective. And there are doctors, particularly a clinic up in Canada that's well known for this, which have had a lot of success in treating children with this condition and helping them to overcome it. So we have a great deal of concern about both of those factors.
Well, gender reassignment surgery is something that you've mentioned a couple of times. Now, some transgender individuals pursue gender reassignment surgery and some do not, but oftentimes it is portrayed in a very positive light by the media. In your paper, however, you cite experts who argue that gender reassignment surgery actually can do more harm than good. What is the media not telling us about gender reassignment surgery when we often hear them talking about it?
Well, obviously, there are limits to how much of a change you can affect in someone's body, even with, you know, the wonders of cosmetic surgery. So a lot of transgender people have unrealistic expectations as to how effective the surgery will be in making them convincing in their presentation as being the opposite sex. This is a problem that a lot of people end up being disappointed. There can be complications, as with any surgery. It can be extremely painful. The hormone treatments that generally accompany surgery can have significant both physical and psychological consequences. And ultimately, you are sort of collaborating in a fraud by helping this person to try to look like the opposite sex when they really are not able to change. And then you also have the problem of if the person experiences regret about their surgery, then there are body parts they may have lost permanently and will not be able to regain. And of course, no amount of gender reassignment surgery, even if it is superficially effective in giving someone the appearance of the opposite sex, there's no way to make their reproductive organs function as the opposite sex. So people also forfeit their fertility through this surgery as well.
Well, significant issues that certainly must be considered, and that the public needs to understand. This is not just a simple thing. It's a very significant surgery and psychological change that takes place here. Peter, unfortunately, we are out of time for this week. I want to give you an opportunity, however, to let our listeners know where they can go to learn more about the Family Research Council and to get a copy of the paper on transgender ideology that you have authored and that we've been discussing today.
Certainly. Well, our website is www.frc, for Family Research Council, .org. So frc.org. And this paper, you can either search transgender, or if you do frc.org/transgender, it will take you directly to this new paper.
Well, Peter Sprigg, I want to thank you so much for all that you do, for working in a partnership with the Family Research Council. We're so grateful for you and for FRC and all that you do to represent faith, family, and freedom on the national level in Washington, D.C. and across our nation. And thanks so much for taking time out of what we know is a very busy schedule to be with us today on Family Policy Matters.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Family Policy Matters is an information and analysis feature of the North Carolina Family Policy Council. Join us weekly for discussion on policy issues affecting the family. If you have questions or comments, please contact us at 919-807-0800 or visit our website at ncfamily.org.